Memories and pain have kept him far away from home and from the woman he once loved. Leaving her behind, she did what she could to keep everything together. But when they're brought back together, secrets may keep them apart. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. We are swimming in slightly new waters as we dive into the Harlequin Desire imprint. We've not been down this road yet, so it will be curious to see what's in store. Our selection today is Homecoming Heartbreaker by Joss Wood. This is part of a three-book series, the Moonlight Ridge series. But interestingly, not from the same author. The three books were written together by three different authors, each one following one sibling from a family-run resort. I think for me, this is the first time I've run into this particular setup, though I know that this does occur in the romance genre. I believe we almost found something similar last year with Cold Case Colorado, but from what I could tell, none of those books had anything to do with each other except for branding, so I'm not going to go ahead and count it. Our author, Joss Wood, hails from South Africa and has been writing since at least 2012, according to Fantastic Fiction. Unlike a few authors that we've seen before, she doesn't just stick to one imprint. For Harlequin, she has written for Presents, Desire, and a now-defunct imprint that I hadn't heard about until just this moment, Kiss. And there are a few other publishers that she's written for as well. But that's not why we're here. We are here for Homecoming Heartbreaker, and it's one that I've had my eye on for some time. While perusing for something to read for the podcast, the cover practically jumped out at me. I've talked a little bit about the racial makeup of the stories that we've read so far, and I've made a note about the fact that a majority of our romantic couples are whiter than mayonnaise and almost never partake in interracial romance, one exception aside. One demographic you hardly ever see in the romance genre to the point of practical non-existence is East Asian men. There's a lot that I could say about this cultural phenomenon, but the short explanation is that Asian men have long been emasculated in American culture, and thus not seen as romantic prospects. When we deal with the romance genre, we really must take care not to judge books by their cover. But I would be lying if the sole reason that I picked up Homecoming Heartbreaker was not because of the cover art. Our cover features a couple standing outdoors on a wrought iron staircase. It looks to be a violet twilight, trees and buildings gently reflected on a still lake surface. Our hero is what caught my attention, a tall man who looks to be of East Asian descent. Dressed in a black suit with a silver tie, he holds the arm of a blonde woman, wearing a shimmering golden dress. Interestingly, she is wearing a ring where a wedding band would usually be. The theme of the Desire imprint is apparently American elite, and judging by the amount of gold our lady is wearing, we are looking at elite status indeed. I have to say, the way the couples stand next to each other is a little off-putting to me. She looks a tad defiant, which isn't a huge problem, but something is off about our hero. I'm not sure I like the grip he has on her arm, but it's not hard to tell that the models have likely never even met in real life. We have that plastic Photoshop effect that Harlequin is famous for. I'm wondering if they've overdone the hero's quote-unquote dominance to offset that Asian stereotype, but I can really only speculate. And I can go on forever about this particular topic, but there will be more to unpack as we get into our story, and plenty of time for it later, so we're going to be going right into the book. We begin with Mac Holloway as he drives through Asheville, North Carolina, on his way to the Moonlight Ridge, the highly exclusive and luxurious resort owned by his adoptive father, Jameson Holloway. Clearly, he is not happy about this fact, but the only reason he's come down was because Jameson had suffered what the book is calling a brain episode. In order to help his father recuperate properly, Mac was returning to Moonlight Ridge to run the resort in his place. It's not an ideal situation, however, since Mac feels responsible for an accident that nearly killed one brother, and all three of them have grown vastly far apart as the result. It was so traumatic that Mac pretty much left everything behind him without hardly a word, including his old childhood sweetheart, Molly. They'd met when Mac was adopted into the Holloway family. He met Molly even before he met Gray and Travis, his adopted brothers. He'd been enchanted by her corkscrew blonde curls, olive complexion, and her fascinating light green-blue eyes. Molly's complete lack of fear of Jameson, a big, burly, dark-skinned man, so different from his slightly built, mean-as-hell Korean biological father, helped him become accustomed to his new dad and his many rules and regs. With Molly's help, he soon realized that Jameson was all bark and no bite. He had Jameson, he had Molly, and he felt, finally, loved and secure. I'm pointing out this passage for two reasons. One, because it establishes part of the dynamic we will now be observing. We get a taste of what's waiting for him back at Moonlight Ridge, that old relationship with Molly and why he feels so connected to her. And two, it illustrates a problem I have with the book. I don't know how deep I want to get into this, because again, I could go on about this forever. But did you notice something when the narration described Mac's background? How his father was A, Korean, and B, mean as hell. The only reason I bring this up is because of the lack of Asian representation we see in these books. By no means am I saying that all East Asians are perfect people with zero problems. Every demographic has its bastards. However, when we bring a person of color into a very white environment and point out how terrible they are as a person, the lack of representation might cause readers to develop unhealthy stereotypes. And Mac can escape that stereotype while still providing an exotic thrill. He was raised by an American business owner in the American South. He can give us the fantasy of having a Korean oppa without having the Korean background. It's dicey, and it doesn't help when the book goes on to say this. They might not look the same, Jameson told them. Jameson and Travis were African American, Gray was white, and Mac's father was of South Korean descent. But taking his name made them his. They were Holloways, and they were still a family. Diversity was strength, Jameson had told them. Differences were to be celebrated, and skin color was irrelevant. But that statement is only half correct. Unfortunately, we still live in a day and age where skin color is still very relevant. Please notice how the narration gives all of the Holloway men an identity as white or African American, but it goes out of the way to say that Mac's father is Korean. Not Mac is Korean, his father. In a weird roundabout way, the book isn't letting Mac be Korean. He just happens to be the son of a man who is of South Korean descent. Mac is being stripped of his background, and we are told skin color is irrelevant. I might be told that I make mountains out of molehills with this sort of subject, but I genuinely believe these conversations are important. Representation matters, especially when the only representation some folks get is a half-baked attempt at a woke version of, but he's one of the good ones. Okay, enough of that, let's move on. In the timeline of Mac's life, he'd grown up alongside Molly since her father worked for Jameson, and she in turn worked for Jameson in her teens. She still works for him now after college, as the manager of the resort. When Mac and Molly had gotten together, they had had 4 months of happiness, and then Mac's accident tore it all apart. Mac then spent the better part of 15 years carefully in control of his life and his emotions, believing that love led to emotional vulnerability, which led to lose control, which had led to the accident. So in his mind, Mac does not deserve love. We cut to Molly Haskell, standing in her office, watching the driveway through the window, trying to convince herself that she was so totally over Mac, convincing absolutely no one. But she also takes her job as the Moonlight Ridge's manager seriously. Before the brain episode, Molly had planned to give Jameson proposals to help bring customers back to the resort. It's been failing in recent years and desperately needs help. Because she was only the manager, she didn't have the authority to make the changes she believes would be vital to the resort's survival. Now that Jameson was laid up, the only person who would have the authority was her ex-boyfriend. This is going to be rough, I think. We briefly meet Molly's best friend, Autumn, the resort's wedding planner and future book heroine. The women get to talking, and Molly wonders if it's normal to be angry about a breakup 15 years ago. Autumn tells her that it was just a teenage fling, nothing more. But we see that this is not the case. Sure, but Mac had been so much more than a teenage fling. Before he'd become her boyfriend and her first lover, he'd been her best friend, her refuge, the one person besides Jameson who had her back. His leaving, without a word or explanation, eviscerated her. The months following his departure had been the loneliest of her life and contributed to her making the worst decision of her 17 or so years, a mistake that still haunted her today. The book keeps coming back to this secret throughout the story, and it doesn't really do anything for me, to be perfectly honest. The lie revealed plotline is lazy and boring and awkward, and the resulting fallout is always frustrating to watch. It's also clear that Molly is not on good terms with her family. She resents Mac for making her feel like she's disposable, much the way her family does on the regular. Autumn leaves her office and Mac arrives. Immediately, despite everything Molly tried to do to convince us that she was O-V-E-R this guy, she falls into the thirst trap that is Mac Holloway. But she tells herself that sex and love are different things, and boy, isn't it great that looks are not important, really? Insert Shakespeare quote about protests here. Mac asks about his father, and Molly tells him that Jameson has fired 3 of his nurses in the last 2 weeks, so it looks like Jameson will have to stay in the house until they can find someone who won't break under the pressure. After Mac leaves, Molly gets a visit from a woman named Beth, her brother's girlfriend, and the resort's accountant. She is apparently very bad at the job, but miraculously still works at the resort, a situation Molly profoundly resents. Molly's father had previously been the resort accountant, but he'd been caught embezzling money. When discovered, he'd been fired, and the family has been hounding Molly for money ever since. Every time she insists that she wouldn't give them any more cash, they threaten to tell Jameson about the $2,000 that she stole from him back when she was a teenager, and frightened that her family would be evicted from their home. And now she gets to work with Beth, a constant reminder of the emotional blackmail her family holds over her. She decided enough is enough, however, and resolved to tell Jameson and return the money with interest. If she was fired, so be it. And then Jameson got sick. That's one reason I find the liar revealed plot so frustrating. There is never a good time to tell the truth, and they always find the worst time to let the cat out of the bag. I'm already dreading what's going to happen when Molly finally comes clean, but now we get to suffer through her family's abusive tactics until then. Beth scoffs at Molly's insistence that she'll tell Jameson about her theft, and as a result, their free ride would likely end. She tells Molly not to confide in Max, if she knows what's good for her, see? An hour after Beth leaves, Mac comes back to Molly's office, and my head is spinning a little bit. As far as I can tell, this all occurred on the same day, and I'm surprised Mac returned so soon from seeing his father, but I guess the author wanted to set up Molly's situation for us so we can feel all of the tension the author wants us to feel. We get ex-boyfriend angst, past mistake angst, and abusive family angst. It's a lot for Molly to carry, but she's a strong, independent businesswoman who is totally over her ex, and her shoulders are strong enough for it all. Mac also recognizes that she's carrying a rather large load, but it all relates to how the resort is being run. There's usually a number of under-managers, but now it's Molly running everything. Mac asks her why, and she doesn't really give us an answer. They talk about the future of the resort, how the targeted demographics need to change, and then they have a spat about their past. Mac gives what is admittedly a pitiable apology, and Molly is understandably pissed about it. They hope that their past together won't affect their working relationship, but given the way that they keep ogling each other the moment the other walks into the room, it'll be unlikely. Mac asks her to set up a proposal and get ready for a meeting with the other departments in the afternoon. I guess I'll mention that Mac is the head of a hugely successful chain of upscale breweries and restaurants. So this isn't a story of a son gone astray and trying to run his dad's business. He knows what he's doing, so we don't have to worry that he's going to muck everything up. A week passes, and we get some perspective from the man himself, Jameson Holloway. Apparently he had all of these plans of a big family, building out a large house with plenty of space for his sons and their eventual families, and that they would all work together at the resort. How's that working out for you? Molly is a little jealous of his dream in a way, never having a real family that really cared enough to have such hopes. She goes to visit Jameson to see how he was doing and sits down at a huge dining table. She's so swept up in daydreams involving a naked Mac that when she hears her name, she stands up so quickly that she nearly falls over and Mac catches her. Well, at least he wasn't pulling her out of the way of a speeding bicycle, but it's still a little cliche. As for the two people who were supposed to be over one another, Mac placed a hand on her lower back to pull her closer to him, close enough for her to feel the hard, very hard, ridge of his erection pushing into her stomach, close enough to feel the shudder that ran through. They shouldn't be doing this, but his mouth on hers was the sweetest honey, the tartest spice, sexy and demanding and amazing. If that's being over your ex, then I have got no idea what they're going to get up to when they actually start doing the do. And I'm not sure what kind of spices our author has been enjoying, but when I think of a spice, tart is not on the list of expected flavor profiles. Our two piles of raging hormones are all but ready to do it right there on the table, and if it's not for a visitor, they likely would have. Said visitor is Giada, a woman who was once a housekeeper at Moonlight Ridge, and had left to pursue her degree in nursing. As an old friend of the family, she'd come to see Jameson when she'd heard about his health. She goes off to see her friend, and Mac and Molly are left with the aftermath of what they had nearly done. Mac bluntly states that the kiss never should have happened, and that he's only here for a little while until things are running smoothly again. He's not looking for a serious relationship, which offends Molly, and she tells him that just because he's come back doesn't mean that she's letting him back into her bed. That is exactly what she said. I guess the table doesn't count then? They push each other away emotionally, Molly declaring that she will never let Mac hurt her again. For now, their only goal is to help the family business keep afloat. Molly and Mac go to check on Jameson and Giada, and we learn that Jameson has been nursing a crush on sweet Giada. They honestly have a cute dynamic, and it's clear as day that they're meant for each other. For now, Giada was taking some time away after her sister had passed, and Mac offers her the job as Jameson's nurse, which she accepts. On their way out of the house, Molly airs her grievances about having left without a word, and being completely avoided on the rare occasions when Mac did visit. Mac gives her a far more robust apology, and his sincerity breaks through to Molly. She insists that their kiss was a mistake, that it won't happen again, and Mac teases her a little bit, telling her that it will totally happen again. Romance aside, Mac, kid, listen. Molly is essentially your employee. No matter what your past was, right now, you're all that's between her and unemployment. She already feels vulnerable, and not just because the business is on the proverbial ropes. Maybe don't make jokes about sleeping together. Bigger men than you have fallen. The next day, Mac runs into Beth as the little blackmailer is tormenting Molly. He's not aware of the situation, of course, but he's keen enough to know that there is a situation. He chases Beth off and settles in with a meeting with Molly. One big problem the resort is facing is the fact that their bookkeeping is still old school, paper-based. It is 2021. Wait, no, scratch that. 2022. How in the heck is a luxury upscale resort still running on a paper accounting system? Well, it's obvious then why the place is struggling. Molly gives an estimate of 6 months to a year before they get in serious trouble. They discuss more proposals, and Mac ends the meeting with an honest admission that he wants to sleep with her again. Real smooth there, Casanova. Sometime later, after another meeting about resort battle plans, Molly and Mac find themselves carrying boxes full of files from Jameson's house to resort offices. During their walk, they talk a little bit about Jameson himself, hot bodies and working out, and we get some more hashtag tragic backstory from Molly. Apparently, she used to dance classical ballet, but she tore a ligament in her knee and was promptly retired. Mac feels bad for her, and the emotional vulnerability gets them close together once again, and they share another steaming, earth-shattering kiss. They manage to break away, only just, and finish the job of walking up the files. That night, though, Molly decides to take the initiative. She finds herself outside Mac's door, arguing whether or not she should actually take the plunge. It's an interesting moment. She has an entire self-monologue about how guys should make the first move, how good girls don't initiate, which, between you and me, is total bumpkiss. She's convincing herself that she's an adult, and able to make the choices to have unattached sex, and gets stuck in this repeating loop of justification. Luckily, Mac is out on his veranda and sees this little show going down and invites her up. How convenient it is when she's telling us that she wants to go against the grain to fight the good girl stereotype that Mac is right there to make the choice for her. She goes up to the veranda and he will not mince words. Molly looked down at his masculine face, wreathed in shadows, and shuddered when his hands moved to her hips and he rested his forehead on her stomach. "I want to take you to bed, Molly." So direct, so adult. But she could do this. Could she sleep with him and keep it simple? She was desperate to believe that she could keep all of the messy emotions out of it. But this wasn't any man. This was Mac, and he was, always had been, hard to resist. As kids, they'd shared a powerful connection, and she'd loved him with an intensity that still, even in hindsight, scared her. When he moved on, her heart died. Molly asks for a few hours, no obligations, and Mac is happy to provide. What happens next is pretty different from a lot of what we've been reading. They stay out on the veranda, and Molly is just too horny to think straight. So instead of the regular in-and-out that I would have expected, Molly basically grinds on Mac's erection until she comes, and Mac is encouraging her the entire time. Once she's come back to Earth, he leads her inside the house, and their night continues. It is a good change of pace, and I am thrilled to see the heroine have an orgasm during any activity other than penetrative sex. Finally, we are getting somewhere. I'm not sure how much time passes now, but the next time we meet up with our daring duo, we see Mac out front greeting guests as they arrive at the resort. This is complicated when Molly's brothers show up, doing a great impression of a hillbilly mafia shakedown. They've long known that they're not welcome on the property, and they are certainly not on good terms with any of the Holloways, so it's a triumph of Mac's patience that he doesn't outright throw them out or call the cops. Molly arrives, and her brothers are bold enough to threaten her in front of Mac, saying that she'd better meet them somewhere else in 5 minutes and to bring what they need if she knows what's good for her. Mac, having heard where they would meet up, catches up with Molly and watches the scene unfold. Her brothers are fully intent on tormenting her, and they admit as such, as she hands over an envelope full of cash. When they leave, Mac approaches her, and he gets to her to release some of the stress she's been holding onto her shoulders. After she gets her tears out, we watch Mac do a cliché, "Oh no, the woman is crying, what do I do, and why is it turning me on?" dance, and they head over to a place where they hung out as teenagers. Mac applies some gentle vocal pressure, and Molly makes him swear that he won't go to Jameson once she's confessed. And thankfully, Mac can understand the nuance of the problem, that a young teenage woman reeling from the loss of her boyfriend and her family being threatened for eviction went and stole a measly $2,000 from Jameson because her family had pressured her to do it. I'd like to hope that I'd be as gracious as Mac in a similar position, but we the readers also have the benefit of knowing the whole story. We know that Molly's family is trash and treats her as a walking ATM, and we also know that Molly is fiercely loyal and devoted to both Jameson and the resort. Her sin is easy to forgive when we have the whole picture. And Mac is slowly getting more pieces of the puzzle for his own picture of the resort as time goes on. He's been using Jameson's office, next to Molly's, and because the walls are paper thin, he's discovered how it's come to be that Molly is buried under such a heavy workload. Apparently, all the department heads and managers have been taking advantage of her own devotion and started dumping their work on her. He pulls the stern CEO move, throws the manager currently bothering Molly out of her office, and demands that she unplugs for an hour with him. He leads her out on a walk among the grounds, and it takes them to this old barn built by the original owners of the resort. As they look it over, ideas start to form on how to bring in more business. Molly's idea is to make it more exclusive, more expensive, something that people wait for months to get into. One way to drive up that desire would be to bring in some world-class restaurants. Mac suggests converting the barn into one of his craft breweries. Their conversation will now turn to a Mac's emotional trauma. The rift between him and his brothers is deeper than just the truck accident. When he was born, his mother had died in childbirth, of which his father constantly reminded him. And when he was 7, his dad had dropped him off at a school and never came back. Riddled with abandonment issues, he was terrified of doing something wrong that would drive Jameson to reject him. And after the accident, it solidified to him that he wasn't deserving of a family. Of course, we all know that none of this was Mac's fault. Unfortunately, he believes otherwise. Molly tells him that an accident was just that, an accident. But she also tells him that the only one who can change his perspective is him. It's good advice, and so it'll take time for the lesson to settle in. That night, Molly decides that she didn't want to leave Mac alone with his thoughts for too long, so she heads over to his place to help him relax. I have to say, they don't beat around the bush when it comes to knocking boots. I'm really not surprised, though, given how they were practically trying to tear each other's clothes off for most of the book. And the narration isn't mincing words either. We aren't getting truly explicit words for the goodies, unfortunately, but we are getting into slightly spicier territory. It was enthralling to be the object of so much focused passion and the reason for his brief, husky statements of appreciation. Needing to feel him, Molly pushed his shirt up so that she could touch his hot body. Her fingers traced the rows of his six-pack and the long muscles that covered his hips before drifting over the hard erection that tented his jeans. Oh, very nice. She traced his long length with the tip of her finger and, because she could, did it again. Condoms are also present in our little moment here, so we get points for safe and spicy sex. There's another time jump, and we see Mac in front of a spreadsheet looking at the numbers over and over again. Judging by the way he's pressing his fingers into his eyeballs, okay, something is very wrong. He sends a copy off to his brother Gray to get another opinion, and hopefully they can get some answers. He gets a call from Gray almost immediately, and the brothers start to ease back into their old rapport. Mac tells him that he wants him to be the architect on that brewery barn, and Gray is excited to accept. Mac is now finally making the moves to knit his family back together again. And what's more, he's starting to feel like he's truly home, and he's not sure if he wants to go back to his base in Nashville. He's got a lot to think about now. Before they hang up, Mac drops the bomb on Gray that he believes someone is stealing from the resort. This touches on an overarching theme of our novel, the one of betrayal. Nearly every character we've come into contact with has either been betrayed or has been committing some sort of betrayal on another character. Mac, for instance, feels his father's betrayal after having been abandoned and also felt that he betrayed his brothers in turn after his accident. Molly has been betrayed by everyone in her life, Mac and her family included, and felt that she has betrayed the trust Jameson gave her when she stole the money. Whether or not any of our characters will able will be able to move past these transgressions will be up to them, and whether or not they can come to terms with their own failures. With the evidence that Mac has uncovered, yet another betrayal is in the works, and they need to find out who it is. All three brothers manage to get a video call in together, and Gray confirms the suspicion of embezzlement via a tactic known as double dipping. Unfortunately, some, not all, evidence points towards Molly, and Mac is quick to leap to her defense. He's not ready to believe that she could be capable of theft on this scale. Then Mac pulls what I believe is a dum-dum move. He wants to get Molly's immediate reaction when he tells her about the embezzlement, so he sets up a meeting and secretly records her as she gets the news. In his mind, he's doing it to protect her. Because if the news gets outside the resort, and Jameson apparently being a big deal in Asheville, the press would be all over Molly, and the court of public opinion would eviscerate her. So if he got an honest reaction on tape, which unfortunately includes Molly throwing up in a trash bin, he can use it as evidence to her innocence. He believes that this will protect her. I am not sure that would work out the way he thinks it would. And he pushes her hard on this. After he tells her that she is a top suspect, we get that first reaction of throwing up, and then he directly asks her how much she stole from Jameson. I am not surprised to see her screaming at him. I would too. He attempts to explain his reasoning, why he's done what he's done, but she is not having it. She calls him out on his scheme to protect her, and while she's yelling, Mac comes to the conclusion that he is, in fact, a big dum-dum. That is my distinction, by the way. She's already been hurt by Mac once before, but it was a mistake made when they were young. You'd think that a self-made millionaire would have had the foresight to consider that this was a bad idea. She storms out of the office, determined to finally leave her past and her love for Mac Holloway behind. If this were a lesser book featuring a dum-dum entrepreneur that violated more than a few boundaries, this would be where the story would end. But this is Harlequin, and we cannot leave our lovers with the third act separation unresolved. And our resolution starts with what I might consider a plot device known as Chekhov's gun. The rule basically states that if there is a gun hanging on the wall in the first chapter, then the gun had better go off in the third chapter. Our proverbial gun comes in the form of Jameson landing in the hospital. The entire concept of this book surrounds the need to keep Jameson out of harm's way, and despite all measures, he still ends up in a powder blue patient gown. Mac is frantic about getting in touch with Molly since she's basically the daughter he's always wanted, but unsurprisingly, he is not getting through. Giada tells him to be patient, and they wait for the doctor to give them their first updates. The news is good, though. Nothing serious has befallen a beloved patriarch, and Molly arrives. Jameson picks up that Mac has pissed her off somehow, without nary a word between the three of them. Jameson is finally sick and tired of being treated like glass and hates that he's not in the know about anything. Mac isn't sure what to tell him when Molly says that she cannot live with her secret anymore. Surprise, surprise, Jameson already knew about the money that's been haunting Molly all of these years. I kind of saw that one coming. We get a pretty good look at Jameson during the story, and it wouldn't have been hard to surmise that if he knew, he obviously wasn't worried, and if he didn't know, he wouldn't have worried anyway. Poor Molly. All this time that she's been eating away at herself with guilt when Jameson saw the problem for what it was. A scared young woman trying to help her family. In a moment to warm the heart, they have a tearful and cathartic hug, and it gives Molly the strength to do what she should have done from the start. She drives up to her family's house and is surprised to see that Mac followed her. Ignoring her request to get lost, he stands behind her as she tells them all what for. Her brothers aren't fully on board, though. When they try to chase after Molly for more torment, I suppose, Mac steps in, giving them some much-needed percussive maintenance. And then he dances with that ever-popular trope of protecting his rescued damsel when Molly's mother threatens to press charges. Mac just handed her a cold, hard-as-steel smile. Your threats don't scare me, Vivi. They never have. Do not contact Molly. Do not let your sons contact her. No text messages, no emails, no visits. If any of you come within a mile of her, I will destroy you. He smiled again, and Molly shivered. Are we clear? I know that it might not be terribly 21st century of me to admit this, but I cannot lie. I really dig this trope. Conveniently, Beth shows up as Mac and Molly are leaving, and we get the satisfaction of watching Mac fire her. Mac gives Molly a little bit of space after this. He checks in with Jameson and finds that both his brothers have managed to get into the hospital room. Mac lays out the foundations for building up their family again, but it is going to be tough. When he catches up with Molly, he comes forward with his failures and admits that he was a big dum-dum. Again, my distinction. Molly tricks us out for a hot second. Maybe she isn't going to throw herself into his arms, but fear not. Our couple reunites, and it looks like a promising future. And that was Homecoming Heartbreaker. It was all over the place in a lot of ways, so what did I think of our American elite romance? I will have to say, in some ways, I did enjoy the read. I'll admit that Mac's background really colored my perception of the book on my first read-through. After putting some space between my first and second go-through, I realized that multiple readings really can sometimes work for the benefit of the novel. Now that I've gotten to the end for the third time, I'm a little softer on the concept. Not to say that I don't stand up behind my original points. I absolutely do. But it prevented me from getting an accurate and objective view of the story as a whole. As for the rest of the novel, we will go ahead and get started with Heather's final score. Our cover is up first, as usual, and that is getting a 3 out of 5. It's a pretty middle-of-the-road number, especially since there are good aspects of the cover and not-so-good aspects. For one thing, I am a huge fan of the color composition. The golds of our heroine mix so well with the violet sky, and the hero's dark suit really makes all of the other colors pop. I don't normally note the color composition like this, but here I am impressed. Unfortunately, I'm not a fan of that guy's posture. I already talked about this at the beginning, but he feels more controlling than romantic, especially with his hand on her arm like that. Drama is a 4 out of 5. There is a lot going on here. We have family tension on both sides of our couple. We have a business struggling to survive, possible embezzlement, the whole nine yards. We lose a couple of points with how silly it all is. For example, Molly's family was a little ridiculous. I haven't seen family that openly villainous since the stepbrothers in Danielle Steele's fairy tale. Beth was just as antagonistic, and the brothers felt more like high school thugs than they did adults freeloading off their sister. Romance is getting a 3 out of 5, and I will use this moment to rename the Lost Lovers Found trope into the Romance Reheat Button trope. I came across this idea because this whole story was the epitome of hot and cold romance. It's like when you go to microwave leftovers and parts of it are screaming hot and the mashed potatoes are still ice cold. It was hard to get into romance grooves when our lovers kept careening from I am totally over you into just take my pants off over and over again. Speaking of which, our spice level will get a 3 out of 5. I am probably being charitable here, but after the drought of insert tab A into slot B, it was nice to see a little bit of a shakeup in the routine. Finally, realism will get another 3 out of 5. Again, some parts worked, some parts didn't. The prodigal son returning to save the family business is a tried and true routine that has worked wonders for ages now, and the family tension was enough to explain how things had gotten the way they were. However, the disasters that befell everyone were a smidgen ridiculous. Separately, they wouldn't have drawn up the eyebrows, but when the abandoned orphan, nearly estranged from his adoptive family, has to return to the failing family business and face his ex-girlfriends who's being extorted by her lazy family and prevent his father from hurting himself with stress, it's a bit much. Oh, and don't forget our mystery thief, whom I am sure will be a painful plot point in the other two novels in this series. Really, it probably could have been scaled back a little bit. But then again, if you are here for melodrama, get a spoon. In the end, it was a middle-of-the-road novel, but that's not to say that I didn't enjoy reading this book. Like I said, there were parts that worked and some parts that need work. But if you enjoy the lives of the rich and sort of famous, this might be something to check out. For my final rating, Homecoming Heartbreaker will get 3 suspiciously ambiguous brain episodes out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.